Good morning. Thank you for having me. Just for entertainment value, we're going to start with an instructive message from a guy who happens to live in this town. Let's see if this works.
The problem has been that the website that's supposed to make it easy to apply for and purchase the insurance is not working.
Anybody see this? Let's go to my favorite part.
Third, we are doing everything we can possibly do to get the websites working better, faster, sooner. We've got people working overtime, 24/7, to boost capacity and address the problems.
That's you guys.
Experts from some of America's top private sector tech companies, who, by the way, have seen things like this happen before. They want it to work. They're reaching out. They're offering to send help. We've had some of the best IT talent in the entire country join the team, and we're well into a tech surge to fix the problem. And we are confident that we will get all the problems fixed. Number four, while the website will ultimately be the easiest way to buy insurance through the marketplace, it isn't the only way. Now, I want to emphasize this. Even as we redouble our efforts to get the site working as well as it's supposed to, we're also redoubling our efforts to make sure you can still buy the same quality, affordable insurance plans available on the marketplace the old-fashioned way, offline, either over the phone or in person. And by the way, there are a lot of people who want to take advantage of this.
It goes on. You guys seen this? I have a tendency to watch CNBC in the morning. And so I woke up one morning and was watching CNBC while I was getting ready. And all of a sudden, I see this press conference. And the president of the United States of America, who is by many people called the most powerful person in the world, at one point in this says, and if you're having problems with the website, please call 1-800. Like, what? What? Like, earlier in the day, he's deciding which country he wants to bomb today. And in the afternoon, he's apologizing to the entire country for website problems. What we do, what we, people in this room, do, has gotten very different in the last 10 years. And this is, I think, to date, the best example of how things are really changing. Where are we today? Where are we going to be in the future? It's not just important what we do, but it's important how we do it. And I tell you, I try not to think so much about where we are today or where we've been. I'm trying to think about where we're going as an industry, as a profession, as a craft. Where are we going? I try to think out far enough that I don't have too many of the answers yet, like 2030. At what point is someone who's in this room right now, perhaps, going to be standing before Congress trying to explain why your site was down for 16 hours? It's perceivable. It could happen. We are at a point today already where if Twitter or Facebook are down for more than a couple of hours, it can be considered by some a national or worldwide catastrophe. And we laugh, but it's true, isn't it? If Twitter's down for a couple of minutes, it's on CNN. These things that today are becoming more and more serious all the time are going to become even more important, and the availability of those resources is going to become a matter of global importance. So I want to talk about not just what we do, but how we do it. Now, I do want to temper it. My name is Ben Rockwood. I'm a sysadmin, proudly. And I'm going to talk about a lot of highfalutin kind of concepts and management stuff and all that. But I'm also a guy who unboxes servers. I wore my data center pants today. And kind of do it, kind of soup to nuts, right? I get nervous about any sysadmin who doesn't like to go and rack stuff in the data center once in a while just to keep grounded. I like to touch the machines from time to time. So, who's read this book? Oh, more of you should read this book. More importantly, well, I think this is an important book for all of you to read. This wasn't actually written for you. It was written for your manager or your manager's manager. All those people who look at you and say, like, why is this guy freaked out all the time? Why is this guy crazy all the time? Why can't we get anything done? Why does it seem like there's no productive work, but everyone's busy, busy, busy? Why the hell does that happen? This book walks you through in a narrative form that kind of process. And for those of you who have read it, if you haven't read it, ask somebody who has. It's actually a painful book to read. It's actually like emotionally trying to read this book because you've got all of your daily problems in your job. Then you go and you read this book and you're reading about somebody else's problems. And you're trying to figure out what he's going to do about it. And you're kind of yelling at the book like, oh, you should have done this, you know. And it becomes stressful. But nobody's ever accurately captured what it is to actually do operations, actually be a sysadmin and deal with all the kinds of problems that we have. We talk about it, but people outside of our world don't get it. We think they do. We think it's obvious to everyone, but they don't. They just see a crazy, frantic guy who goes gray way too early. And I want to make sure that when we talk about manufacturing stuff, you don't think it doesn't apply to us. I'm going to tell you a story about a guy named Hank. Year is 1890-ish, and there was a kid. He was supposed to take over the farm, as many kids in his era were, and he didn't really like the farm at all. It just wasn't for him. He didn't know what he wanted to do, but he didn't want to run a farm for the rest of his life. When he was in his early adolescent years, his father gave him a pocket watch. And he thought what would be more fun than using the pocket watch would be to take it apart. So he did. He took it apart. And then he put it back together, and then he took it apart, and then he put it back together. And he did that until he got profoundly bored, and then he went to all of his friends and asked for their pocket watches. Took them apart, put them back together. And he just loved to tinker with things. It's just what he enjoyed doing. He actually got so good at it that everyone told him that he should go and become a watch repairman. He was become a master watch builder at that point. And he actually really thought about it. And what he was really interested in was well, how could I do this at a large scale or something like that? But ultimately, it wasn't enough. And something else had come along that he was very interested in, which was steam engines. See, at the time, the horseless carriage was a new concept, and they weren't actually cars to begin with, actually. They were portable engines that could be used for farm work. And what you would do is when you needed to transport this thing, you would take the belt that you would normally connect off to whatever it is you were going to power, and you would connect it to the wheel, and it would push itself home. He got really interested in that. And then gasoline engines came along. He got interested in that. And he started to tinker around with these things. It was just a new thing to do. And like many of us, there were certain aspects of this he didn't really understand. Like he needed to use electricity in the engine for it to go with spark plugs and whatnot. He didn't understand electricity, so he went over to the Edison Company and got a job. Got to learn all about electricity. This went on and on, and he built ideas on top of ideas, and eventually came to start a company that was named after him, Ford, Henry Ford. Henry was just a geek. He was just a geek. And it happened to be that his passion was not just building things, but he was always thinking about how to do them at scale, very large scale. And the problems, working out the problems about building things at scale. And he got very good at it. So good that the term mass production was actually first officially coined when it was added to the Encyclopedia Britannica. And they were going to create the entry in the Encyclopedia Britannica under the subject Fordism. And he thought that was a little too egotistical, and he decided, no, no, please, could you change it to something else? Let's call it mass production. So the reason, you know, it's, and which is funny, because everyone today says, oh, you know, everything, our education system, our healthcare system, everything is based on mass production and all that. This isn't an abstract idea. This came from a very definable root. This was all picked up by the Japanese. You guys have probably heard this story before. The Japanese, after being bombed into the Stone Age, after World War II, had to rebuild industry. They had a lot of problems in trying to catch up with the U.S. and a lot of struggles. They developed a lot of techniques in order to get their production level up to American standards, and they had a target of 3 years, which everyone said was impossible. But they set the goal. You have people who like to build things. You have problems to solve. That's where a lot of these ideas we're going to talk about come from. I'm going to share this with you because I do this. I talk at a lot of developer conferences, and I use this slide a lot of times. It's hard to tell these days who's an administrator and who's a developer. And so I like to use this. I tell them, look at this statement. You're going to work for my company, and this is what we're going to do. Now, what's the first thing that pops into your mind? If it's what programming language we're going to use, you're a developer. If it's what servers we're going to buy or what platform we're going to build it on, probably an administrator. I don't know if you guys have noticed this, but it's very hard these days to tell who's what. You know, where in what camp you fall. I find this to be a useful way of helping figure out where people fall. But we're going to talk about flow. So flow, everything we do should be about flow. And when you think about flow, do you think about a peaceful brook? Or do you think about bureaucracy? What comes into your mind? This is the flow that I care about. This is what I call the DevOps flow. That is that there are business people on the left here who produce requirements. Those requirements fed into dev. Dev produces software. That software is fed into ops, who weaponizes it and turns it into a service. And that service is then consumed by customers. Those customers provide feedback, which then goes back into new requirements. This is the flow. Important thing about this flow. Two things that people have to keep straight, and a lot of people don't, and it makes things very confusing. Things get a little bit easier when you make this distinction. If you look at any of the wisdom out there, the production of a good and the production of a service are two very different things. People who take processes that were intended for the production of a good and apply it to a service have all kinds of problems. Sun and no. Goods are artifacts, things they produce, right? Most development teams can produce software, cut a build, and then walk away for 3 weeks, right? Those of us, administrators, we can't do that, right? You're there or you're not. We provide a service. So you see this again. Dev side, we're talking about goods. The other side, we're talking about service. It is the working of these two together, the production of a good, turning it into a service, providing it to a customer. Another thing that we need to take into account when we look at flow is systems thinking. Right? We have to look at the whole. What OS you run does not matter. No one cares which operating system your service runs on. They care that the service is available. We have to think about these things in a holistic sense, about what's important, and understand that the value that comes out of a system comes from the sum of the behaviors. From a product of their behaviors, of the interactions. All right. So again, this is a system, right? We want to see continuous flow. The faster you can iterate through that flow, the more competitive you're going to be able to be. In DevOps, we can separate things out into people and process and tools, but it's the collaboration of the people, it's the convergence of the process. And it's the creation and exploitation of tools. Tools are important to be sure, but they need to serve a process, and that process needs to serve people and the collaboration of those people in producing goods, services, and delivering quality. Okay? Can you see it? Now, a lot of people have a hard time thinking flow. What does flow look like? Well, everyone's seeing flow. You see flow all the time. If you go to a restaurant, you see flow. If you have a bad experience in a restaurant, it can be for a wide variety of reasons. The kitchen's not using quality ingredients. They're not sourcing things properly. It's coming through in the food. They're not turning out the order fast enough. The waitress is going on breaks at weird times. You're not being seated quickly. In a restaurant, we see a wonderful example of a system where flow is absolutely integral to the experience. And with any system, garbage in, garbage out, right? It's really important to start at the beginning. So let's look through some patterns here about doing this in a practical sort of way. Start with why. Always start with why. What are you trying to accomplish? How many projects have you been involved in where you start getting into trade-offs of, are we going to do it this way, are we going to do it that way, are we going to do it this way, are we going to do that? Oh, well, if we do this, then it affects that. And it's only days into the process before somebody goes, wait a second. What were we trying to do? I don't actually remember. What were we actually trying to do? Whether it's in a small scale or a large scale, always start with why. And that does come down to who you work for. Why are you at your company? Why is your company in business? What are they in business to do? Are you on board with what they're producing, or do you just like their technology on the back end? An important thing here is intentionality when you look at why. If you look at any self-help book on how to be better at anything, it fundamentally comes down to one thing, intentionality. You need to be thinking about what you're doing. You want to improve your marriage? Think about your wife. Think about what she needs. Think about that, right? If you're going to talk about improving your operations, think about your operations, right? The problem, of course, and the reason self-help generally doesn't work is because you can't be present in all things at all times, right? So you get focused on something for a while, it improves for a little while, then you forget about it, it falls away. As an organization, you need to know why you're in business, what you're going to do. Everyone in the organization needs to know what that is. When you know what you're doing, you need to build trust relationships, right? This is what most people think of in the DevOps sort of thing from a dev and ops kind of perspective. Simon Sinek says that when we're with people who believe what we believe, trust emerges, right? You don't trust people because of the fact that they do what they say they're going to do. You trust them because of the fact that you have something in common with them. You have a shared beliefs. One of the best ways to do this, if you're having trouble building relationships in your organization with different teams, is have one-on-one meetings with individuals and do it outside of the office. Go to a bar, go to a pub, get out of the office. You'll find that the conversation changes dramatically when you're not in the office setting. The walls sort of come down. This is really, really important for the leaders. So if you're a manager, if you're managing teams, take the lead to do this. Set a pattern for people to follow. And it's also important to know that you do not have to be friends with people to trust each other, to share beliefs. Once you've established that what you want and what I want, the two things that we believe are true, are aligned, things get better. You don't have to go and, you know, play squash together. Then it's important to share the vision and align the culture. When you know what your why is, spread that to people. Make sure that they understand what you're really all about. Make sure that the trusting relationships that you build extend throughout the organization, that people follow that pattern and people understand that there is trust, right? So that your subordinates are not fighting with those groups. Propagate the idea of flow, systems thinking, throughout the organization. Make sure that people are on board with this. And if they're not, fire them, which is a harsh thing to say, but fire them. Because they're going to weigh you down. And every company has that one guy who's always upset. And a lot of times, it's unfortunately someone in our group, right? It's the classic kind of graybeard bastard operator, right? And it just doesn't work. And in the new organizations that are trying to be focused not on the technology, but on the the product and the quality of that product, it just doesn't work. Here's an interesting thing, Conway's Law. This was written back in 1968. Organizations which design systems are constrained to produce designs which are copies of the communication structures of these organizations. This is really interesting because you ever thought about the fact that the way your infrastructure looks might actually have some similarity to the way that your company looks? I know that I've looked back at a number of different organizations that I've been a part of, and I've seen dramatic similarities. We say that this is broken, that's broken in the infrastructure. We say this is broken in the political or organization, and it turns out they're very, very similar. Pattern four is value stream mapping. So when we look at the different subsystems within our organizations, fundamentally we start with resources. Value is added through a variety of phases, and then we provide the result to a customer, right? Comes in, we touch it, we add value, it goes out, right? This is the general pattern of business. So we need a system to visualize that, and that's what we use value stream mapping for. A lot of us do, you know, Visio diagrams and things like that, but the problem with those diagrams today is that they're based on components. They're not based on the actual process. We can't see the flow. When people have to touch things, we need to see that in that flow and be able to visualize that. Because once you can see that, say, you know, a process like, you know, adding additional servers to your data center involves, you know, ordering, then there's a wait time, then it is delivered to the dock, then there is a wait time for people to go on site and unbox it and stage it for deployment, on and on and on, right? There's all these different phases. There are wait times in between these, there are queue times, there are scheduling things that need to be done. When you can map all that out and actually see what the process looks like, you can see some amazing things. Generally, a lot of considerable waste. If you're going to play around with mapping, I recommend buying this book. It's a Shingo Prize-winning book. It's fairly inexpensive. It's written for manufacturing, but it's a fantastic read, and will help you get on your way. You'll easily see parallels between what they're doing and what we're doing. And you can see an example here of kind of a value stream map as it's applied. Notice it has a time component for cadence. Fifth pattern, standardize all of your work. Document the processes for each stage of your value stream. Employees should never have to struggle to know what to do. It's really painful when you delegate a task out to somebody and they say, okay, yeah, sure, I'll take care of that. And then 2 days later, you're like, hey, why didn't you finish that? They're like, well, I wasn't sure what to do. Well, it wasn't exactly like what I expected. Oh, I'm not really sure, right? That should never be the case. You should have standardized process so that when people need to perform work, they can perform it quickly and get onto the more interesting things. Don't just do this for the big things. Do this for everything. Make it a part of your culture that you're going to standardize your work, you're going to document it, and you're going to follow that process. And don't let people do it in a different way. Don't tolerate the hotshot who goes out and goes, well, that was a dumb process, so I'm just going to go do it a different way. He should be improving the process. We should always be improving the process. So one of the things with both policy and standardized work is people think that once it's written, it's cast in stone. That's not the way it needs to be. There needs to be a culture of change and improvement of those processes so that over time we can evolve them. And what's important is then we can see what we thought was the right way and what we found was a better way, and we can see the organization improving. Also, include the time component with each process. How long does it take to do? And make sure that the person who wrote the process is not the person who adds those times. Have somebody review the process, make sure that it's coherent, and have them say how long it took them to do it. The next is to manage work through the value stream. So Kanban, is anyone using Kanban? Cool. Oh, a couple people are flaky on it. Kanban is an excellent sort of system. It's great for visualizing workflow. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. I don't think it's the golden way. But it is handy. I use LeanKit, a lot of people do. Some people use physical boards, but I have a virtual team and I think it works better. It should not replace a ticket system. Please do use a ticket system. But you can use tickets, you can reference tickets in the cards, and then you can see what everyone's working on. This also makes staff meetings a lot faster, because everyone knows what everyone else is working on. Very handy way to do it. I use it together with ITIL. In fact, actually, if you look on the board down there, you see the purple cards are actually changes. So it doesn't need to compete with anything else. It can work with them. And what I like about it is that it's independent of any given system. So if you have multiple systems, you don't have to. Everyone's not lost. A lot of this comes down to identifying Muda. Muda is the Japanese word for waste. Literally, in Japanese, it means futility. Anything that you're doing that is not adding value to the end customer in some way is waste. Don't just do things for the sake of doing them. So there's a couple of, you see this all the time, right? We're masters of identifying waste as administrators. We love pointing out waste. But we produce a lot of it ourselves. Excessive meetings, great form of waste. You're not producing value. Excessively large changes. Insufficient change data. If somebody wants a change pushed out, they don't tell you what it is, guess what? Now ops is, we end up having to go and do our own validation and things like that, code reviews. It's absolute waste, doesn't need to be done. You want to stamp out Muda using Kaizen. So what is Kaizen? Kaizen is process improvement. This is the important thing about Lean, is it's not just a thing that you do, it's a mentality that you have and a set of processes that you follow going forward, and that means constant improvement. It doesn't mean that you ever have arrived. There's no point at which you ever lean or you've made it. It's a constant, intentional process of improvement going forward. So Kaizen in Japanese literally means change for the better. We use what's called the PDCA cycle, plan, do, check, act, which is pretty simple. Most of you know it as a scientific method. Right? Figure out what you want to do, make some observations, make a hypothesis, perform some experiments based on your results, make a decision. Then repeat that cycle and do it again and again and again. Be very intentional about what you're doing. A lot of us, to be honest, a lot of us are just embarrassed by our infrastructures, different processes, different components. And the last thing we want to do is write it down. We tend to be very prideful, right? And we don't want to admit how broken something is. And that's unfortunate because it keeps us from using tools that would really help us. Focus on both what your current state is and what your desired state is. You know where you are. You need to know where you're going to go. This is another thing a lot of us do in technology projects. We don't know where we're going to go, but we know that there's a better way. Because we went to Lisa and heard about some new tool, and we're going to try that. I don't know what I'm trying to achieve, but I think it's better than where I am. Know where you are, know where you want to go. And if you don't know where you want to go, then just scale it back. There's some point along that path that you do know what you want. Go for that thing. Make the changes smaller. In the Lean world, they have a number of tools for this. Like we talked about PDCA, Plan, Do, Check, Act. I actually prefer Deming's wording, which is PDSA, Plan, Do, Study, Act. I think it makes it make a little more sense. In manufacturing, they use something called an A3 form. And if you go into a factory, if you ever get to go on a factory tour, I recommend you do it. When you walk onto the factory floor, you'll see a board that will have a bunch of these sheets of paper. It's called A3 because that's the size of the sheet of paper. It's an A3 sheet of paper. And on this, you would say, provide some background, say what you want to change, provide some metrics and some data, then you come up with some remediation ideas and the end goal and perform your results. And all this is done on one sheet of paper. The idea is if it can't fit on one sheet of paper, it's too big. And if you can't fill this out, you don't know what you want to do. So they will submit an A3 for a change that they want to make, and then they'll put it up for public display, and people can look at it, comment on it, and they implement it. I don't necessarily believe that A3 is something we should do, you know, with one of these forms, but definitely the idea is applicable, right? Have a template in a wiki somewhere for what you want to do, current state, future state, observations, et cetera. And remember, efficiency is doing things right, and effectiveness is doing the right things. Very, very important. A lot of us work at efficiency, getting things to work better, when in reality, they shouldn't even be done. Pattern 9, Jidoka. This is autonomous automation. It's fault detection is what we call it. And it's the idea of finding your faults at the time that you're performing the action, not sometime later. Quality at the source. Some examples that we have of this kind of catching on as part of the configuration management sort of movement is building idempotent tools, right? None of us should ever write a script again that can only be run once, and if it's run a second time, like, chaos ensues. TDD, automated security scanning, things like this, clear error reporting, exception handling in our programs, and alerting, monitoring, dashboards, things like this. When problems happen, we need to know about them right away, quality at the source. Pattern 10 is Gemba, literally meaning where the work happens, or go and see. This is an important thing throughout the organization. Go and hang out with other people. Go to their meetings. Go have lunch with them. Go, if you have a support organization, if you're in a company where you have a support organization, just go and sit with the guys on the phone or whoever's answering the queue and just watch them work for a while. See how they work. Spend time with them. Avoid assumptions and investigate the situation for yourself. And then the last one here is kata, meaning form, right? If you've seen anyone who does karate, they practice their moves again and again and again and again. Those are kata. The idea is for doing practice in karate is that when you get into a real fight, as soon as somebody throws a punch, you automatically just follow the kata and kick somebody's butt. That's the same sort of thing we need to do in our companies, is we need to have patterns for how we do things and build these forms that focus on the way that we solve the problems, not just outcomes that are produced, and that we repeat them again and again and again to build habits. So this is a review of the patterns, kind of high-level ones for the organization, day-to-day ones here sort of in white. Kaizen is a constant ongoing process for improving this. And then some practical things that we should be doing all the time, which is kata and gemba. So most important, know who you are. Know where you are. Know where you want to be. And then make that happen using good, solid, repeatable patterns. Thank you. I have 30 seconds for questions, so talk quick. I have 10 minutes?
You just
had
30 minutes.
Oh, man, never mind, I'm not done. Let's watch more YouTube videos. Well, if somebody thinks of a question, I'll show you the... This is what went through my head after I saw the Obama thing.
Plus it's Christmas.
I heard your call, my brothers and sisters. Let us go forth to victory!
Tony just blew up all of his suits!
Saith what? Why wouldst thou do this?
Yeah.
Saith what? No questions? You've got these things? The mighty John Willis.
Sir. Great, great presentation, as always. The question I have, it's more of a comment / question, your thoughts, and we've talked about this. So you talk about value stream mapping, mm-hmm. which is extremely important, and you talk about MUDA, eliminate waste.
Yep.
And then you kind of tie that back to Gene's book, you know, with theory of constraints, right? So I think there's a cautionary tale in there. We've talked about this in that we tend to look at value stream mapping and we see, oh my God, look, I could fix that. I could chef-ize that, or I could do this, or there's waste, kill it, right? But we need to make sure that we always bound that back to the global optimization.
That's right.
And I'm having that discussion right now with Chris Brown and a couple of people on Twitter just as we speak about this idea that we've got to be really careful. Those are important things to watch out for, but we have to make sure they're always in line and bounded with the global optimization. Because local optimization, for example, the discussion we're having right now, putting Chef in and slamming it in, it could be Puppet, it could be CF Engine, it could be anything, really could actually destroy things and make things a lot worse. And I'm working with a customer right now where that is the example, because they didn't have the why. They didn't understand the global.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, doing anything just for the sake of doing it is a mistake. Like, I hate Nagios. I think that anybody who's using Nagios, like, just hates themselves. And because of the fact that you continue to use it, you hate the rest of us. Because you legitimize it. I mean, it's just a piece of trash. Now, it was really cool. 2001. Man, that thing was rocking. But it's 2013, for crying out loud, stop. But that said, all the problems that you have, is that the one thing you need to do is go rip Nagios out? Is that the best use of your time? Does that provide value to the business? Probably not. Probably should just leave it alone, as much as it pains me to say it. And that's why we have to temper our feelings about things, right? There's a lot of us who don't write solid programs because we can't decide which language we want to write it in, right? Just pick one and just write it, you know? Focus on the whole. Focus on the outcome and how you're actually going to ultimately benefit customers, end customers, not just internal consumers.
Hey, thanks for the talk. It was really good. One of the questions I have when thinking about this stuff is a lot of your comments here and in other talks I've seen you give are inspired by operations research and sort of the focus on production automation in factories. And I think that's understandable, right? Because it's a rich body of science and learning, and it's cool to draw from that. One of the things that concerns me is I think that set of research and set of techniques draws from this experience of taking a fixed asset and optimizing a set of production processes through that fixed asset in order to extract value for customers.
You're right.
Like, or optimize some process. But
you're right. Goods and services, like we talked about earlier.
Sure. So one of the core pieces of that that worries me a little bit for our world is the fixture of it. It is true that for right now, for the near future, not forever, factories are things in places that have a set of machines in them with a set of constraints, and that's very expensive and difficult to change. That just turns out not to be true for software. So how do we extract useful learning, useful techniques from that world without reifying, if I can use a sort of college level English word, the software that in fact is malleable in a way that the factory just isn't?
You should spend some time in a factory. That's more similar than you think.
You think that factories are as modifiable as software in roughly similar
scale? They're a lot more modifiable than you think. In fact, I will tell you that one of the things that shocked me when I spent time in factories is that lean is adopted in manufacturing very similar to the way DevOps is being implemented in our shops, where people don't understand it. They just want to rip quick tips from it. And there's a couple of people in each company who are like their lean guys, and everyone hates them. Right? They're like, all he's ever talking about is efficiency. I just want to go home at 6 o'clock and have a beer. Like, why does he constantly want to do process improvement? What the hell? It's had a hard time catching on there too. Because this is it's a paradigm shift. It's the way you think. And it's one of the reasons I talked about Henry Ford and Toyota at the beginning, is that these guys wanted to improve things, they had problems, and they solved those problems, and they came up with ways. So it's important to not just take things lock, stock, and barrel from manufacturing and apply them. I think that's what you're getting to. And that's why I'm not telling you to go out and take, you know, SMID, you know, single minute exchange of die, and implement that, right? We actually have. The equivalent of single minute exchange of die, which was developed by Shingo for Toyota, we call it configuration management. Right before, in order to switch over a pressing machine to make the next part, it would take hours and hours and hours, in the same way that deploying infrastructure for us would take days. Right? Then we found configuration management. Now we just run it, and it's all configured instantly. So there are parallels, But the principles are the things that are important to do. And what's really critical, what has to happen in our industry over the next 20 years, is we need to spend time thinking about how we work, what's right, what's wrong, what needs to improve. That's what DevOps ultimately is about. And it's drawing on all these other places, whether it's reliability engineering, resilience engineering, lean, and lots of other different fields that we're looking into, trying to draw the things that are useful and apply them as ways to go. You notice that healthcare did this. Healthcare is big on lean, right? And it's like, well, in a car, in a manufacturing plant, they're making a car, and over here they're fixing human beings, right? And like, there are great talks you can listen to about Q theory and how it applies to both production on an assembly line versus a human being in a hospital. Like in a factory, the car doesn't just walk away. In a hospital, your patient gets tired of waiting and just leaves, right? Like how do you deal with that problem of missing inventory? Because there is a lot of humor factor if you get into this. If you're in a hospital, you are the work in progress. I'm a big believer in common sense. If you hear any idea that seems really, really clever, and like you never thought of it, and it's just really clever, like immediately reject the idea as ridiculous and stupid, right? Any idea that you ever hear that is truly genius, the instant you'll have one, you'll hear it, and the first instance you'll go like, whoa, and then 2 seconds later you'll be like, well, everyone knew that. I've always known that. Those are the ideas that stick. Is anything in here seem new to you? I mean, raise your hand if you think that this is ridiculous crap that you've always been doing. Anybody? No? Some of you are thinking it, I know, right? Hey, Gemba. We have a term, Gemba, right? What does it mean? Go over and frickin' see what the guys are doing, right? All of us have meant to go over and hang out with another team, see what they're doing, but we never get around to it, right? Eliminate waste. Right? We have terms for these things, but honestly, there's nothing here that you didn't know before. This is just putting together in a framework that makes it easier for you to reason about it, think about it, and be intentional about it. Did you have a question? No? Anybody else? All right, thank you.